Well, would you give Mike Snavely for Mission Imperative a warm welcome?
To my slide. Oh, it just went to my slide. That's okay. You notice that water hole there? Okay, you notice that water hole there? There are times when you can be at a water hole, and I can see three types of animals. You have elephant, wildebeest, and zebra. You can actually be at a water hole at certain times of the day or afternoon, whenever, and you can see a lot more animals than that. You can sometimes even see predators. Like, you'll sometimes even see lions walking through, and as long as the lions are behaving themselves and just kind of walking along, then all this kind of animal, they know that they're not dangerous, and they know to be, they know they can coexist with them. What's amazing is you can see all those animals together, and they're not afraid of each other normally. I mean, these animals all get along. Have a human being walk out there in front of them, and they will all scatter. Why? It's amazing. I always ask our people that when we take people on wildlife safaris to Africa. Why is that? It's because after the flood, God said to Noah, he says, I'm going to give you now, just as all the green plants were food for you, I now give you all the animals. Well, that would have been an instant recipe for wiping out all the animals on the planet. So God, right after that, says he put the fear of man into the animals at that point, which is interesting, because what does that say about prior to that? And we'll look at this briefly tomorrow morning, but anyway, so he put the fear of man into animals. They don't fear each other, basically, but they fear man, because every time they see a man, they run. And that actually has protected them all these years. But that actually shows a big difference between us and every other creature on the planet. The evolutionists tell us that we evolved from a so-called ape-like creature. That's nonsense. And that's one way you can tell. They won't run away from a baboon or a gorilla even, but they'll run away from a human being. So that's another interesting little bit of evidence. All right, so now I guess we could go back to the other slide here. Okay, perfect. So what we're doing this weekend is these are part of a core series that we do. We're going to be doing all of these this weekend except the one in the upper left, and the one on Aunt Lucy. So we're going to be doing the one right closest to me, the Pillars of Evolution, and then the one in the middle at the top. We'll do those two this evening. And then we'll do the lower two on the left tomorrow morning. And then tomorrow evening we'll do the Dinosaur Program and Ancient Civilizations. So you're getting the core series that we do. And that's what we have some DVDs at the back there if you're interested in that. And we can talk with you about that when we go back there and have a look at that. So the other thing we have is recently, maybe within the last 5 years or so, we've started another series for kids. These are like 4 to 12 that we aim these for. And they are designed, it's the same subject matter, but in an adventure format, and there's lots of wildlife. So that's kind of what these are for. And we found that parents like to watch them as well, because everybody likes that wildlife, you know, so that's what these are for. So we have two different series, and we can show you those at the table. Anyway, so what we want to do tonight is I'm going to start off with the big heavy. We'll start off with the big heavy. Now, if you survive this first session, the rest of them will be a breeze. And again, I say survive the first session because it deals with the whole idea of evolution. And so we have to get into a little bit of science here. So some people are afraid of that word. And you know, so that's why we try to get this one done first. And this is not rocket science. Anyone can understand this stuff. There's nothing too difficult to understand. It is basically easy tools that you can get in your mind, get into your heart, so you can understand how it all works. So I call this the Pillars of Evolution. Why do I call it the Pillars of Evolution? Because if I'm going to believe something, if I'm going to get onto an airplane and trust it to get me to where I'm going safely, there's certain things I need to believe about that airplane. I need to believe, number one, that the designer of the aircraft has good reputation. So I look and I say, okay, it's an Embraer or a Boeing or whatever. I'm going to believe that the pilots have had adequate training and the airline knows to hire people who've had adequate training. Okay, so you get the idea. So there's certain things that have got to be true for me to put my faith in it. It's the same thing with a belief system, like evolution. If evolution is going to be true, at least appear to be true enough in my mind or in your mind, to accept it as a fact, there has got to be some pillars along the way, like pillars that sort of support a building. That's kind of the strength of the building. What is it that supports it? So the pillars have to be strong and trustworthy. So in other words, you should be able to look at some basic ideas behind evolution, or any thought process for that matter, any idea, and say, okay, because this is true, and this is true, and this has stood the test of time, all these pillars are solid, therefore I can trust it. That's why I call this the pillars of evolution. And it is based basically on something that I watched a number of years ago on television. I was watching a scientist for a while, and he was talking about science. He's talking about evolution, the whole hour. At the end of the hour, he said, now, if you believe that there's a God who made you, that's just religion. And he just kind of pushed it off to the side. He said, but evolution is based in science. Ah, I thought, okay, that's a good place to start. Now, again, many people are afraid of that word science because they think, well, that only involves intelligent men and women in white lab coats that do brilliant things in laboratories. And so, and while that's part of it, really, we shouldn't be afraid of that word science at all. It simply means knowledge. That's all it means. If you look at Webster's dictionary, Webster defines it as science is knowledge as opposed to ignorance or misunderstanding. In other words, on one side, you know something. It's just stood the test of time. You know it. It's true. On the other side, you either don't know anything about it or else you've completely misunderstood the data. How do scientists get this knowledge? How do they don't just guess. How do they wind up with this knowledge? There's something called the scientific process that you have to go through. And I'm going to boil everything down into its basic, simplest form. You can get infinitely more complex than this, and you can basically talk over anybody's head using all this fancy scientific terms. We're not going to do any of that. The scientific process is actually very simple, but before we do that, let me just give you a quick, easy definition for science. Science is the process that people use to try to answer questions or solve problems. That's all it is. Science is the process that people use to try to answer questions or solve problems. So when you hear a statement like this, and how many of you have heard this? Science versus creation. How many of you have heard that, right? We've all heard that. Or science versus the Bible. Wrong. Science does not have opinions of its own. Science is merely a tool. It has no opinions. We add the opinions based on what we observe in the scientific method. And so that's essentially what it is. So science is merely scientific instruments, but scientific instruments are used when we're trying to go through the processes of trying to answer questions. So, with that in mind, let's boil it all down. So here are the basic steps in the scientific method. And by the way, I like to define science as mankind trying to figure out how God did it. That's essentially what science is all about. So here are the basic steps. First thing you've got to do is identify the problem or identify the question you're trying to answer. Now that might seem simple enough to look at, and it is. But there are certain fields where it might take you years just to understand that. Like certain fields like medicine, it might take you years to understand, let's just say that there's a disease that somebody has or a lot of people are getting, and there's no cure for it at all. And so that's a problem, okay? But just identifying the problem in a realm like medicine, that could take you years. But still, that's the first step. You have to identify the problem so you know what it is you're trying to solve. You understand that? Okay, so that's the first step. The second step is easy as well, to conceptualize anyway. You come up with a solution to solve the problem. So once you think you've solved the problem, once you think you've understood the problem, you've now attacked it, you've tried to think, hey, this is how I can solve the problem. And now the third step is you have to test the idea. Now, in a very simple way, let's illustrate this. Let's picture you're going out for a walk in the woods somewhere, and a bridge got washed out, and there's a little chasm with a little stream in there, and you got to get to the other side. So that's your problem. So now you have to identify, I've identified my problem. I want to go over there, but I don't think I can run and jump that far, so I've got a problem. What in the world am I going to do? So you look around, and you see a big log. And you think, hey, I wonder, that log is long enough. I wonder if that log looks strong enough. If I drag it over and maybe throw it across and And then span the thing, maybe that'll work, okay? And so that's your solution. You have the problem, you're gonna solve it by putting this log over. Now you have to test the idea and see if it works. So now you're gonna start walking across that log. If it's rotten and it breaks, well then your idea didn't work too well. But that's putting it in super simple terms. When you're talking about medicine, let's just use that as another example again. This could take years. For example, it might take you years to identify the problem. So let's just say there's a disease that a lot of people have. Let's just say you are the scientist working on that disease. You spend years, you have identified the problem. Now you're going to work on a solution. Maybe you study different kinds of chemicals. You study different kinds of tree oils or sap from leaves or something. And you say, okay, I'm going to combine these things together. And I think if I put them in a pill, I think if I give somebody the pill, that will make them better. So now you've come up with these three ideas. You've identified the problem. You think you've solved it. You have a pill now you've made. And now you have to test the idea. Well, who are you going to test it on? You're going to test it on somebody who has the disease. Ah, but now the testing phase has three things that you have to do in a testing phase in order to be calling it science. Here's what they are. First of all, the tests must be demonstrable. You have to be able to demonstrate to people what it is that you are saying is going to solve the problem. Secondly, the tests must be repeatable. And thirdly, they must be observable. You have to have all three of these. If you don't, well, then you don't have any kind of a scientific theory. You don't have any kind of science behind it. So you have to be able to demonstrate it. So with that in mind, let's just say that you now have your pill. And you can't just give it to one person because you have to be able to repeat it. And let's just say that you do find one person with the disease. And that person comes up to you and they say, I'm sick. And you say, here, take this pill. I think it'll make you better. What if that person comes back to you the next day and they say, oh, I feel great. You might say, yes, I found the cure for the disease. But you don't know if it was your pill that cured them. You see, it might be something else that person did. So that's why you have to divide your people into two groups. One group that doesn't take your pill, one group that does. And so it gets a little more complex, but still, the whole idea is you have to be able to repeat it. You can't just give it to one person. You got to give it to a bunch of people, men, women, old, young, just all kinds of people. And then you have to observe the results. So let's just say you've taken all that time to study the disease, you've taken all that time to come up with a cure, and now you think you've got the cure, and you've got 1,000 people. So you give them all your pill, and you're all excited. They come back to you the next day, and they say, we don't feel any better at all. And you go, Well, take 2 of my pills a day for 2 weeks, then come back. They do. They come back, and nobody's any better at all. So you say, take 4 pills a day for 4 months, then come back. They come back in 4 months, nobody's any better. And you say, okay, take 16 of my pills a day for 2 years. At the end of 2 years, they come back, nobody's any better. Folks, would you say that you have found the cure for the disease? No, you wouldn't say that, because using the scientific method, you have now shown and proved that your idea doesn't work. Somehow you made a mistake. Maybe you didn't really understand the disease properly, or maybe there's something wrong with your concoction that you've come up with. But let's just say that you're really stubborn and you say, look, I don't care what the data says. I don't care anything about the results. My pill works. Are you basing it on science now? No, you're basing it on pure stubborn faith. So let me make a statement here. Any theory that does not meet those three requirements is not based on science anymore. It's based purely on faith. Now let me stop here a minute and tell you, I'm a creationist. Not because science has proved creation. Science cannot prove or disprove creation because creation is not a science theory. Creation is a biblical assertion supported by the evidence. That's essentially what it is. It is a biblical assertion supported by the evidence. In order for this to be a science theory, what would we need to do? Because you and I know what the Bible says about creation. God spoke and it stood firm. That's the best definition for creation is found in Psalm 33. He spoke and it stood firm. There it was. Let there be an elephant. There's an elephant. Okay? That's creation. However God does it, however he speaks things into existence, that's creation. But in order to prove it scientifically, How would I have to do that? I'd have to have God with me at all times so that anyone who would want to say to me, okay, create again, create something, and then and create another elephant, let there be, there's an elephant. Okay, create a zebra, there's a zebra. But what if God wasn't with you the next day and somebody came and said, prove creation again? I can't because God's not with me. You follow? It's always about the here and now. Science is always about the here and now, the demonstrable, the repeatable, that you have, and the observable. It has to be that. Those are the rules of science. Those are not my rules. Those are the rules of the scientific process. Creation cannot possibly follow those rules. It's a biblical assertion supported by the evidence. In fact, the next program we do is called The Hunters and the Hunted, and it's talking about the evidence. Even Jesus Christ said, look, believe the miracles alone. If you don't want to believe that I am the Christ, at least look at the miracles alone as convincing evidence. So what he did is he said, in the Bible, no matter what translation you use, first five words are all the same. In the beginning, God created. Okay, that's good enough for me. I have no trouble with that. But it's still a faith issue because I can't see God creating. So what he does is he gives us Romans 1:20, which is the evidence for design. So much so that if you cannot see design in every single thing around us in the world and above us out in space, there is absolutely no excuse. So he gives us the evidence that backs up the whole idea that he created. But it's not a science theory. Creation is not a science theory. It's a biblical assertion. But evolution is billed as being a science theory. Therefore, it must follow the rules. Are you with me with that? Okay, so what we want to do now is apply those rules to the evolution idea. We're going to start by drawing this like a building. I'm going to say that the roof of the building is the theory of evolution. And here are three pillars. You might come up with some of your own pillars. These are ones that I personally would need to see as absolute solid pillars in order for evolution to even have a ghost of a chance of standing up in my mind. So here's what the pillars are. Somehow everything had a beginning. They will say it was some sort of a big bang. Nobody knows what happened. Some sort of a little speck developed an instability some 16 billion years ago, and that age is always changing. Some little speck exploded, and when it exploded, it made everything that you and I now see in the universe over huge amounts of time, of course. But that little speck exploded. And by the way, we could spend the rest of the evening just asking questions about that. Most evolutionists have completely dropped it because they don't know anymore. That's what they used to say. They still say it, but we just, every now and then we take a group to the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. So the pastor of a church and Carrie and I went to the museum again just to scout it out to see what is new there. Do you know they have completely abandoned that first pillar? Not that they've abandoned it in their mind, but they abandoned trying to defend it scientifically. Because nobody, I mean, look, if everything in the universe is contained one little speck, then it cannot explode. Because remember, a mass produces gravity. The Earth has its own gravity and pulls things toward it. Well, if everything in the universe was contained in one little speck, it can never possibly explode. That's the first thing. When it exploded, it somehow sent out gas and dust and everything, and somehow all those began to reconform into stars, and the stars were throwing little bits and pieces of themselves off, and those bits and pieces began to form planets and go around the stars, and they concoct a whole story, but they don't tell you some of the basic ideas. Where did the speck come from? And how long was it there before it developed some sort of an instability and exploded? And where did it come from? You see, they have no answers to those questions, so they quietly abandon it. So now the museum, which used to spend a whole lot of time in little theaters trying to explain how all this happened, they don't even mention that. But somehow there was a big bang 16 billion years ago. And that eventually made our sun, and eventually our sun threw bits and pieces of itself off, and here came our planet. Our planet eventually cooled off. Somehow on the surface of this planet, something like 360 million cubic miles of water developed on the planet. On the surface. It's just, that's in our oceans alone, 360 million cubic miles. Where does that amount of water come from? Go to any natural history museum, they have no idea, they have no explanation. But somehow there's a huge amount of water, and in that water, supposedly, life began. Now, think about what's in water. It's got, you know, billions and trillions of atoms in a little thimble full of water. But in that water are all the different little atoms that are locking together chemically and then coming apart. So anytime two atoms lock together, it's called a molecule. So they're locking together, 2, 3 millions, who knows how many, and they're locking together and coming apart all the time. But about 4.5 million years ago, an exact accident of exactly the right atoms in exactly the right places in the perfect sequence and everything accidentally locked itself together. Somehow that accidentally figured out how to form a skin around it to protect it from other things outside it that would kill it. Somehow it figured out where to get food, which is a major problem. How did it sustain itself? Where did it get food? And fourthly, it somehow figured out how to make more of itself, reproduction. We are never told how that happened. We're just told to believe that somehow it did. So he had that first little cell accidentally forming 4.5 billion years ago in, according to Darwin, maybe a little warm pond or in the ocean somewhere. And that would be the second pillar. Somehow life came from non-living matter. Then entered Darwin. Darwin said, okay, you already have life, now it needs to get more complex. And so Darwin said that first simple life became complex over these last 4.5 billion years, and that's the simple to complex pillar. That's essentially Darwinian evolution. And all three are based on huge amounts of time. 16 billion years worth altogether of time. That's what they claim. Everything is about time. Time is the backbone. Time, according to one evolutionist, is the miracle worker. Time is the key ingredient in the recipe of evolution. If you don't have millions and billions of years of time, you cannot possibly have evolution at all in their minds. You can't have it at all, even if there's trillions of years. But in any event, in their mind, that's where you have to start off with, was millions and billions of years. Creation needs no such time, especially since the Bible says God spoke and it stood firm. It didn't say he spoke and it eventually came to be. He spoke and it stood firm. But anyway, that's something we'll look at tomorrow. But time is the kingpin of all of this. So now let's have a look briefly at these pillars. We want to just look briefly at the first two, and then we'll spend a little bit more time on that third one. Let's have a look at the first one. Some of you will remember May of 1980 when Mount St. Helens went through a big bang. Remember that? Okay, you probably even remember where you were and what you were doing that morning that the mountain exploded and began to get the news all around the world that this huge mountain had exploded and kind of ruined everything. So now, what did we learn from this explosion? What do we observe from explosions? Do they make things more complex or do they make things less complex? Ask anybody who's ever been involved in the military, ask them what a hand grenade does or what a bomb does. Does that make things more complex or does it make things less complex? Folks, this is not a complicated question. And you can throw anything at it like the evolutionists like to do. They like to throw in all these big terms, and in an open system, energy might do this, and a closed system, forget all the lingo, folks. Explosions do not make things more orderly. They make things less orderly. You can actually look at the area right before the explosion. Think of all the millions of creatures, large and small, living in those woods. Little creatures like fleas and ticks and flies and gnats and mosquitoes, to bigger creatures like deer and elk and desert giraffe. No, anyway. So, and think of all the fish up in Spirit Lake. Think of all the millions of creatures there. Then the mountain went boom. After that, they called it a dead zone. I wonder why. Because explosions don't make things more orderly. They always make things less orderly. We are being asked to believe that when a speck exploded, with a simple addition of time, you and I and everything in the universe that is so perfectly balanced, accidentally came into being. If you look at the distant stars, distant things that Hubble Space Telescope has been able to look at, this is as far as it has been able to see out into space and get a clear image. You think you're looking at stars, you're not. Every pinprick of light that you are looking at, even the tiniest ones there, There isn't a single star there. Every pinprick of light you're looking at is an entire galaxy containing billions of stars per galaxy. And you're looking at a tiny pinprick of sky that has been blown up for you to see on the screen. Now, scientists have looked at this and they have marveled at what they can see. The different colors, they argue about what the colors mean. They argue about why some of these galaxies have big tails coming off of them. Some of them don't. Some of them spin, others don't. That's another big question. Why does anything spin in the universe and some things don't? The Earth spins, but the Moon doesn't. Why? I mean, why does anything spin or why does anything not spin? See, there are no answers for that. They like to try to come up with them because they're scientists and they're curious, and I can't take that away from them, of course. But when you come up with something that excludes God, you're going to come up with nonsense. All of these things are astounding. There was a Penn State professor years ago who said, in order to get our universe to the place where it is now that we can see, would have taken numerous miracles. Ah, miracles, wait a minute. Doesn't that imply God? You see, it's astounding what you look at. When you look at that and understand the implications of what you're looking at, your mind will immediately say one of two things. Wow, the heavens declare the glory of accident. Or, the heavens declare the glory of God. Now, which one seems more reasonable? If you've already chosen to exclude God from your life, then that one will not make sense to you. You're going to choose by default, that's just part of the random chance. So now, let's look at a little closer. How about comets that just came, basically are in our own little local solar system? What is a comet? A comet is a very lightly packed snowball or ice ball going around the sun. When it reaches the sun and it goes around the sun, it speeds way up. It's moving very fast as it goes around the sun and it develops a tail. The tail does not follow the comet like when you see a plane going across the sky, you see the contrail following it. That's not what happens. As the comet goes around the sun is blasting the comet apart. So the tail always aims away from the sun as it goes around the sun. So that you can tell the sun is over here. So it's blasting it apart. Now, since the sun is blasting the comet apart, what does common sense tell you is eventually going to happen to the comet? It's eventually going to get blasted apart. If it comes around the sun so many times, there's eventually going to be nothing left. Scientists know that. They know that. They know that a short period comet, which is a comet that comes around the sun every 200 years or less, cannot possibly last longer than roughly 10 to 20,000 years. Why do we still have comets then if the solar system is billions of years old? That is a problem. Remember what science is? It is the process we go through to solve problems or answer questions. Here's a big one. Why do we still have comets? They should have all disappeared billions of years ago. Their answer to that, of course, and there's probably many, but the one that they sort of all land on is out in the solar system, deep in the solar system somewhere, is a comet nest. Now, they don't call it a comet nest anymore because that sounds too juvenile. They call it the Oort cloud. And if supposedly every so often, boom, a comet gets booted out of the nest and starts on its way to the sun. And isn't this such a lovely explanation for where we get comets from? I've had people call me over the years about, you know, asking about their children in science class, they're learning about the Oort cloud. I said, really? What are they learning? There's nothing to learn. Because if you ask any scientist who is studying it, ask them the main questions. Have you ever observed the Oort cloud? No. Have you ever demonstrated that it's there? No. If you've never demonstrated, then you certainly haven't repeated the demonstration. It doesn't even meet the three rules of being a science theory, folks. It is purely a hypothesis. It is purely a guess. There's nothing science about it. Do you follow that? There's nothing scientific about it. You can't measure. You can't observe it. So then they say, oh, yeah, there's an Oort cloud. No, there isn't. Where do these things come from? Well, we have another program as part of our second round series called The Stricken Earth that goes into a lot more about that kind of thing. But anyway, so that's just some problems out in space. Let's go to the second pillar and have a look at life from non-life. Now, usually at this point, I bring along a textbook just for weight reasons. I didn't bring a lot of the different props that I have in the airplane. But I sometimes bring one of the biology textbooks, and you can see all kinds of things through that textbook that are observable, demonstrable, and repeatable, and you can see all these kinds of things, but always they try to handle where did life come from? And then usually just in the page or two where they try to describe where it came from, it's full of words like scientists think, it may have. And in my book that I typically bring, there's three pages that describe what they think might have happened. There's no fewer than 40 words in three pages, 40 words like they think, it might have, it could have, they think, they presume. Full of words. You know, do those sound like science words to you? No, those are all essentially guess words. And at the end of that whole section, it says, this hypothesis has sparked the imagination of many scientists. Well, I guess it has. So many of them went back into the laboratory. Now think about it, folks. These are intelligent scientists, intelligent people, using controlled circumstances to try to recreate life in a laboratory. They failed miserably for years and years and years. Nobody ever succeeded in even coming up with the first building block. All they ever were able to produce that looked like anything was a poisonous amino acid that was actually deadly to living things. So they stopped doing it. Why? Because the only thing ever observed and demonstrated and repeated about life is that life comes from life. Living things always come from other living things. It's called the law of biogenesis. That's the only thing that has ever been observed. But they have to assume that even though that's observed now, they have to assume that right back at the beginning, there was an original cell that somehow became alive. No, there wasn't, but they have to just assume that because you can't observe it. So it's all automatically, it's already not science. Now, let me show you something. In Darwin's day, when they looked at the cells that make up your body, when they looked at the cells, they had very simple instruments. So their microscopes were very simple. All they could see of a cell of any living thing was that it looked like a little packet of goo with a nucleus in the middle, kind of like a battery. So something like a skin, goo, and then a little cell, a little nucleus in the middle of it. So they called it the simple cell. They said the simple cells, trillions of simple cells make up living things. They don't call them simple anymore, folks. Now all scientists know that the cells of your body, every single one of them, inside, it is just as complex as an entire city like Albuquerque. Every one of your cells. Now think about this. Hopefully this will blow your mind when you think of how complex this is. You have 100 trillion cells that make up your body. Not 100,000, not 100 million, not 1 billion, not 100 billion, not 1 trillion. You have 100 trillion cells that make up your body. That is way beyond anything that my mind can even imagine. And every one of those cells has a nucleus in it that contains your DNA, your unique DNA. That's why you look different from anybody else. You have your own unique DNA. But inside every cell of your body is the information needed essentially for any other part of your body. In other words, all of your cells contain the same DNA as every other cell, but they're not functioning as any other cell. What do I mean by that? Look at your eye, for example. At the back of your eye, you have your retina, and in the retina are rods and cones, millions of them at the back of your eye. The rods and cones allow you to see light and dark and black and white and color. And they are incredibly designed, so even if you get some of them burned out, like if you accidentally look at the sun, it'll sometimes burn out some of those cells, but they reproduce so quickly and replace. So it's astounding what happens in your eye. But each of those rods and cones are made up of millions and trillions of little cells in them. They have the information to be a kneecap, or a liver, or a stomach cell, or a skin cell, or a toenail, but they're not. Who or what turned off the information in the rods and cones of your cell to be a rod and cone? Why is that information on there and all the information to be any other part turned off? Same thing with any part of your body, your liver. And your liver, there are so many different filters in your liver, it'll baffle, it's astounding what goes on in your liver. But just take one part of your liver cell. The information to be a liver cell where it is turned on. The information to be a skin cell or a rod and cone is turned off. Who or what turned it off right where it is? These are the miracle questions of life that you can't answer because everything is operating by this phenomenal blueprint, which is what your DNA is. It is a blueprint for building you. But who read the blueprint to build you? What language is it written in? Who reads the blueprint that builds you? This is what is so phenomenal about this. Let me explain this. You're looking at a city. You are not looking at piles of bricks, piles of glass, piles of wire, and piles of pipe. You're looking at all of those things, plus many other ingredients, that literally make the city and build it into something meaningful. You're not just seeing the raw materials, but even if you were seeing just the raw materials, you'd still have a big question to answer. Who or what gathered the correct materials? What if all the piles of building materials were all cotton? Could you build a city out of piles of cotton? No, who or what assembled the bricks, the wire, the glass? Do you see what I'm saying? So not only do you have to have the right building materials, but in your cells, they're all it's all pre-assembled into an incredible functioning thing. And every cell in your body is just as complex as that. And you have 100 trillion of those in your body. This should be enough to have, it would just stop evolution in its tracks. This is incredible complexity. But you know what? That's only the first problem. Remember, science is about solving problems or answering questions. Evolutionists have two major problems to overcome, two major questions to answer. We've just illustrated the first one. The first one is, where did that kind of complexity, where did it come from? How in the world did that kind of complexity come about? But that's only the first question. Here's maybe even a more important question. What is life? This computer is a very complex machine. These TVs are very complex. The machinery back there is very complex. All this stuff is very complex, but they're not alive. How in the world did something, even with all the right atoms locking together, what made it alive? Do you know that is still one of the biggest mysteries to any scientist anywhere? They do not know what life is. Nobody knows what life is. Look, I grew up at a mission hospital in South Africa. My dad was a bush pilot for a hospital mission station, so I've watched a lot of things. I've helped with autopsies, I've helped with operations, kind of on an emergency basis if there's anybody available to help and not, you know, kind of turned off by, you know, that getting involved with that stuff, so I did. And I've watched people die. I've seen people die from gunshots, spears run through them, diseases, you name it. I mean, a lot of different things. But one guy I still remember, and it just for some reason this stuck in my mind. He was alive, and the doctor was talking with him. They had already loaded him into my dad's airplane, and I was actually there with him. And he was talking. He was alive. Then suddenly he went, ugh. So they quickly called the doctor. We were transporting him to another hospital that was bigger than ours that might have been able to save the guy. Well, anyway, they immediately called the doctor. He ran out with a kit. He worked on him for, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes. He couldn't revive him. So he finally said, well, at 6:41, this man died. What happened? Nobody knows. Because we don't know what life is. The guy was just alive. He was just talking with the nurses. Why did he die then? Why not 10 minutes from now? Why not 2 years from now? Why not 10 years ago? Why now? What happened? Look, the complexity is still there. His body's still warm. His blood is still there. What happened? Nobody knows because we don't know what life is. Oh, we try to in the dictionary. We've come up with some meager explanations, but this doesn't say anything about it. We say, well, it's a certain quality that distinguishes a functioning being from a dead body, or it's a force, or it is a certain state. No, that doesn't tell us what it is. All we can do, all scientists, secular scientists can do, is try to describe what a living thing can do, but they still don't know what life is or where it came from. Look, the The teachers I used to have in South Africa in the public school system, when trying to describe life, they would say, a living creature should be able to do the following. It should be able to take in nourishment, excrete, grow, move, reproduce. In other words, there was a list of things that living creatures can do. If it can no longer do any of those, we say it's a dead creature. Okay, fine, but that still doesn't tell us what that force is. What is it? What is it that makes the creature able to move, able to reproduce? That is still a mystery. Nobody, no scientist knows what life is. There is one place and one place only that tells you exactly what it is. And you know where it's found, and you'll even recognize some of the places where it's found. In him, who? Jesus. In him was life. Jesus speaking now, I am the resurrection and I am life. I am the way, I am the truth, I am life. For in him, Jesus, we live and move and have our being. In other words, whatever this force is that we call life is the essence of Jesus. He made us and then he breathed his spirit into us. I guess that's what the Bible says. And he breathed himself into and made Adam a living creature. He made dogs and cats and, you know, giraffes and so forth, living creatures too, but they don't have an eternal spirit like we have. But still, life is not even understood by any scientific process known to man or any explanation known to man. Because the creator is also the life giver. So whatever that mysterious force is that we cannot identify is the essence of the creator. He is life. That is astounding to me. This should literally end the argument. It should literally stop it all dead in its tracks. But you know what? It won't, because we have a lot of people who just don't like the idea that there's a God who had made us with rules. It's the rules part we don't like. We don't like somebody else telling us how to live. We don't like somebody drawing a line in the sand and saying, this is good, this is wrong, this is moral, this is immoral, and so forth. We like to make our own rules, just like the Hebrews did in the book of Judges. Everybody did what was right in what? Their own eyes. Okay, so the last pillar is simple to complex. Now, here's Darwinian evolution. He didn't really get involved in the first two pillars at all, but the first two were necessary for him to even have his theory. So it's simple to complex. How simple and how complex? Well, if you were to take the simplest microbe on the planet, a single-celled microbe on this planet that's alive, and write out its code, do you know how long its code would be? It would fill two Encyclopedia Britannicas 500 pages long. That's how complex the code for the simplest microbe on the planet would be. That your code, if it was written out, wouldn't fill just two volumes that same length. It would fill over 1,000 volumes the same length. Where did that amount of complexity come from? Now we're going to redraw the building, because that third pillar, and we're going to make it the roof of the building, because it has its own set of pillars that the evolutionists are relying on for it to be true. First and foremost, they'll say, creatures were able to adapt over time to different environments, different changing environments, climates, and so forth, because inside their bodies, their cells were mutating, they were changing. And then Charles Darwin's watchword, he said natural selection was weeding out all the things that the creature could not find useful, that were not beneficial to the creature, keeping the whole evolution process going at all over time and pure random chance. There's no guiding anything. It's all the luck, because nothing determines a mutation in nature. They just happen. It's a mistake in the copying of genetic material. So these are the pillars of Darwinian evolution. So what we want to do is look at that first, look at that middle one. This is the kingpin. Mutations is the main vehicle through which we supposedly evolved. So somebody might say, okay, what is a mutation? A mutation, just by definition, is a mistake in the copying of genetic material. What does that mean? And here's what it simply means. When you were first formed in your mother's womb, you were an equal amount of information from your mother and your father, and that became one cell. You were one cell in your mother's womb. Now think about it. Your DNA was so complex that if it was written out, it would fill over 1,000 volumes, 500 pages long. But you didn't stay one cell. You are 100 trillion now. So that cell had to become more, had to start multiplying. So what happens is the information in the cell copies rapidly and then made two cells. Copied rapidly again and made four. Copied rapidly and made eight. Copied rapidly and made 16. And that's how you grew in your mother's womb. Now think about the information that is copying. It is a massive amount of information that is copying, and scientists have now discovered in the cells of your body spell checkers to make sure that the cell copies correctly. You thought Microsoft invented the spell checker. It didn't. It was already in there. But still, if there is one thing that is not exactly like the original, we call that a mutation. Now, if I came here tonight and you walked in and I said to you, wow, you're looking like a mutant tonight. Okay, now why are most of you grinning or snickering? Because you know that I'm not giving you a compliment, right? Because all mutations are harmful or deadly or at best neutral. I have a friend in South Africa with two thumbs on each hand. No, and they tried to operate. Well, they couldn't operate to remove the one thumb because it would have damaged his other thumb. So they thought, you know, it's not hurting you, so let's just leave that other thumb there. It doesn't work properly, but if he were to come over here and you'd see him with his two thumbs, nobody over here would say, sir, let me shake your hand. You're evolving into a great baseball catcher one day. Nobody would say that. They'd look at his thumb and they'd go, check that guy out, check that guy. He's got two thumbs, he's got two thumbs. And the person next to you would say, shh, I know, I saw it. Don't make a scene, you know. You know there's something wrong. He's not supposed to have two thumbs there. But that's a mutation that's not killing him. Somehow the information for thumb, when he was forming in his mother's womb, the information copied again and put another thumb there. Well, that mutation is not killing him, but there's something not right about it either. Okay, in any event. So that's what a mutation is. A mutation is a mistake when genetic material is copying, and mutations are almost always harmful or deadly or at best neutral. Now, let me illustrate it in a super simple way, folks. The stuff I do is not rocket science. This should easily be able to be understood by anybody. Let me super simplify what I'm about to say. Let's illustrate what I'm talking about. Let's pretend that you're in the military and you're in an active war situation, and your commander says to you at night, I want you to sneak, while we're all sleeping, I want you to sneak out in front of the lines and watch the enemy positions. If you see them doing anything, type a message back to us on this little pad we send you. So you sneak out there and you're watching during the nighttime with your night goggles. At 3 o'clock in the morning, you see the enemy coming. So you quickly get out your little keypad and you type this message. This is what you intended to type, and that is exactly what you typed. So since that is exactly what you intended to type, and that is what you typed, there are no mutations in the message. Do you follow? Okay, now, what if in your haste you made a little mistake and you typed this instead? Is there anything wrong with that message? That's not how you spell the. But notice the letter that was the mistake there was not a new letter. The A was already there. If that was replaced by a Z or a J, that would be new information. Do you follow? That's not what mutations do. Mutations cannot add anything new. They can only take what's there and copy it wrongly or destroy it or make a mistake or whatever. So now notice something. It's not a new letter, but it was put in the wrong place. Now, if you were the commander and you got that message, would you still get the idea of what's happening? Sure. This is an example of a mutation that is harmful in the sense that it's not a pure message. You know, there's a mistake there, but it's not going to kill you either, because the commander's going to wake up and he's going to realize you made a spelling mistake, and then he's going to wake up your units and you could defend. This is like my friend with the two thumbs. It's not killing him. But let's just say that that wasn't the mistake you made. You made this mistake instead. Does that change anything? Now, this changes the whole structure of the message, the whole meaning of the message. But you notice the T was not a new material. The T was already in the original. But now this changes the whole message. Now if your commander gets the message, he's going to wake up and say, well, if they're not attacking, what are you waking me up for? I only wanted you to wake me up if they're coming. So that he goes back to sleep and your whole position could get overrun. This is a super, super oversimplified way to at least help you to understand a non-mutation versus a sort of a benign mutation versus a serious mutation. And again, this is super oversimplifying it. So if we talk about mutations that are observable in living things, so you can look at dogs and say, okay, there's different kinds of dogs around the world showing normal genetic variations, but when there's a serious series of mutations and something that goes wrong, then you wind up with creatures like this. Anyway, no, okay, so let me illustrate it in this way too. Let me draw a code that you're familiar with. You all know what the alphabet is. So this is a very simple code with, what, 26 members. But if you take certain members of this and put them together, you can make words. So if you take a simple series of them, like C, A, and a T, and put them together in a precise way, you will get a warm, furry animal. But if you make it ATC or TAC or CTA, it's not going to communicate anything because there's nothing in our language that we relate to that. But we suddenly go C-A-T-R, now we can relate to it. Now, folks, if you take C-A-T over to China, will they understand what this is? No, because they have a whole different alphabet, right? Which brings up the question again. What language is your DNA written in, and who or what read it to build you? You and I can read it because we're reading English. The Chinese couldn't read that. So something or someone can read your DNA code to use that blueprint to activate it and build you. That's the miracle of life, which evolution cannot even understand the terms, let alone explain how it works. So now, but cat doesn't tell us anything. You have to have other words to know something that's going on with the cat. So let's put some other legitimate words up there. Let's put computer, the floor, and table. Are these the legitimate words? Sure, now put them all in a sentence. Cat, computer, floor, table. Didn't communicate anything. What about if I jumble them around? Table, computer, floor, cat. Am I communicating anything to you? No. Because I need to have proper modifiers and the parts of speech to put words together so that they're glued together in a certain way that your mind can comprehend. So if I put a whole bunch of words together and I use proper punctuation, proper capitalization, I even organize them into sentences, I organize them into paragraphs, I mean, you can clearly see what I'm trying to communicate to you now, right? Now, folks, if you put a million monkeys at a million computers for a million years and just have them bang away at the keypad, you are not even going to get monkeys accidentally forming one page of legitimate words like this. Those are all legitimate words, right? They're all legitimate words, but I'm not communicating anything to you. In order for me to communicate, there have got to be the proper words associated. I have to say, the cat is crossing the road. Ah, now I'm saying something with the proper words. Now it's creating a picture in your mind. Here comes a Mack truck. Oops, poor cat. Okay, so now with a few simple words, we've told a brief story. Folks, your DNA code is not just one page, 500 pages times 1,000 volumes of readable, build-upon material, not just a whole bunch of gibberish. Again, it's the miracle of life which evolution cannot even begin to explain. No mutation has ever been shown to add more complexity to the genetic code. It always ruins it or corrupts it in some way. So that's just the whole idea of mutation. Some people say, well, wait a minute, what's adaptation? Because some Christians don't believe that creatures adapt because they'll think that that is some sort of an evolutionary process. No, we can adapt. Creatures can adapt, but it's not an indication of evolution. It's an indication of design. Let me show you what I mean by that. This is a dog that I had in South Africa before I came over here to go to college. This is Dusty. He was a German Shepherd Kies Hound, a large dog, about 75 pounds. And he always looked like that to me. For 4 years I had him in South Africa. Took him everywhere with me. Came over here and went to college in northern Minnesota. I didn't know what I was getting in for. I only had a pair of sandals and an old beaten up pair of Sunday shoes that I never wore. So I got to northern Minnesota. My roommate looked at me and said, is that all the shoes you have? I said, yeah. And he said, do you know where you are? I said, yeah, Bemidji, Minnesota. He goes, do you know what winter is? I said, yeah, it snows here. He goes, no. You're dead meat. Well, I found out real quickly what winter in northern Minnesota was. I found out real quickly what 35 below zero feels like every night. So that year went through. That year ended, and I was going to go back to South Africa to do some short-term mission work for that 4 months. And some friends of mine who were going to get married on the campus that summer, they were going to move off campus just to the edge of it, move on to this little rental facility, had a fenced-in yard. They said, hey, when you come back, bring your dog with you. That way he can be here with you on campus, and you can have him here with you, and you can visit him anytime you want. We'll keep him outside. And okay, so I did that. I brought Dusty back with me. There was a time in the middle of winter. Now understand, winter in Minnesota, winter begins August 1st and ends July 30th the following year. So that's winter in Minnesota. Anyway, in the middle of winter, there was about a six-week period that I couldn't see my dog. So I literally, because I was too busy, I finally, after 6 weeks, I went up to see him. I didn't recognize him at all. He was huge, but he had not put on any weight. He had grown this incredible coat of down. He looked like a gigantic pom-pom with little ears sticking out, a little black nose. I didn't even recognize him. So in the spring, when I combed all that stuff out, it filled two garbage bags full of that hair, that fine hair. What was going on? Dusty was able to adapt from the South African climate, which was relatively warm year-round, to northern Minnesota. Why? Because he was suddenly evolving? No, because he was originally designed that. Let me illustrate the point using Tinker Toys. I stole my kids' Tinker Toys years ago, and so I've been using it ever since. So let's just, again, this is super simplifying it, and I apologize to any scientist for doing this, for corrupting it so badly. But anyway, it helped to illustrate the point. Let's just say that this was Dusty's code, DNA code. Let's just say that this stick represents the ability of his body to grow that soft, downy hair, okay? When Dusty was in South Africa, he had that code. By the way, where did he get it? He got it from his parents. Where did they get it? They got it from their parents. Where did they get it? They got it from their parents. The whole way back to the original dog kind that God created. When God created all the different animals, he gave in each original kind a huge variety of genetic ability, knowing eventually the earth was going to have all kinds of environments, wet, dry, hot, humid, cold, whatever. He knew the creatures would need to adapt to different environments. So he gave them each a huge amount of genetic variability in the each created kind. So this was passed down to Dusty, and Dusty had that code. He never needed it in South Africa. Now I take him to Minnesota. Now suddenly the ambient temperature drops dramatically, and he would have died. But his body, in essence, says, man, it's getting cold. Do I have any way to stay warm? Yes, look at this. I have a built-in coat mechanism. So he could grow that coat of down because he now needed it. So in essence, Dusty is adapting because he already had the code to be able to adapt. Do you understand that? This is so simple. If Dusty was a terrier type of dog that has had that code turned off or weeded out, he would have died. There would be no way he could live in that kind of environment. And by the way, if you weed out all of the material, and so there's no information left, then you have a Chihuahua. Anyway, so that's essentially what's going on with adaptation. Adaptation is a very real thing, but it's not an indication of evolution. It's an indication of original design. And lastly, as we bring this to a close, natural selection, Charles Darwin's watchword. He was saying that creatures, information or things in a creature that they could no longer use, mutations and organs and whatever, that it could no longer, it can't use anymore, would weed out. So natural selection, the teachers in South Africa used to say, one way we can observe this is by watching survival of the fittest. Oh, so what is that? We go to the game reserves and the teachers would say, what do you observe the lions killing? The lions always, at least it's easy for lions to kill the young, the old, the mutant, the weak, the sick, the ones that are easy for them to catch, leaving the healthier ones to go on and produce babies of that particular kind. They just assumed that we're weeding out the weak ones so that the other ones go on to evolve. No, the only thing ever observed and demonstrated and repeated is that zebras go on to make zebras. Warthogs go on to make warthogs. That's the only thing ever observed. We never watched a warthog turn into an elephant. And so that is the only thing ever observed about this. Now, in Charles Darwin's day, and they still like to use this, I do not know why, because it has been disproved so many times, In Charles Darwin's day, he saw all these finches in the Galapagos Islands, and he made a correct observation. He was saying, well, look at this one in the upper left. That type of finch is different from the next one over on that island. And that one there is different from those finches on that island. And this fourth one here is only found on that island. So he correctly assumed that the finches somehow were changing. The Christian church at that time did not understand simple genetics, and they said, no, 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 those finches aren't changing. Uh-uh. The Bible said God made every creature after its own kind, and those finches aren't changing at all. Guess what? Darwin was right. But was he seeing evolution happening? No, he was seeing the exact opposite. Let me illustrate that. What is that first one called? It's a finch. What's the next one called? It's called a finch. What's the next one called? It's called a finch. What are they all called? They are all called finches. Charles Darwin could not have known this. But way back then, he could see one type of finch, and that's the third one on that second row. That's the large ground finch. That one, let's kind of build our little code again here. Let's pretend that this is the DNA code for that type of finch. And so let's just pretend that that one there is, that one is the matriarch of all the finches in the area. In other words, that one, his code looks like this. Again, super simplifying. The one in the upper left, his code looks like that. The next one, his code looks like this. The next one, his code looks like that. The next one, his code looks like this. Do you see what's happening? The finch is getting ever so slightly less complex each time it's removed. That is the opposite of Darwin. Darwin needs new stuff added to see his theory work. He was seeing the exact opposite. He's not seeing evolution working. He's seeing the opposite working. And they've now proved that, but there's so many scientists, so many people around the world who still look at Darwin's finches as that evidence for evolution. No, it is evidence for the exact opposite. The finches are all essentially getting simpler. Though this large ground finch has all of the DNA, has all of the information that the other ones have to a lesser or different degree. It's just like dogs today. When God made one original dog, that original dog kind produced a huge variety that we see on the planet today. When I was in Romania speaking, my main translator was also a guy who was sort of a big wheel with the Romanian National Public TV. So he took me out to the Bucharest Zoo, and we did a little movie at every single animal pen, a procreation movie, at every single animal pen that was going on national TV. So we get to the wolf pen, and there's a big sign there, and Christy Tsepesh said to me, he says, Mike, let me translate the sign. Wouldn't this be what we would believe as Christians? He said, here's what the sign says, the wolf. In every dog on earth lurks the wolf from whom they all came. You get that? In every dog on earth lurks the wolf from whom they all came. What the Bucharest Zoo paid for by Animal Planet, by the way, what they were asserting is that the wolf is probably the original dog on the planet. Now, they might be right genetically, I don't know. But they are claiming that the wolf, from the wolf came all the huge variety of dogs we have on the earth today. And they're claiming that they actually believe that, and that's very likely what it was. It might not have been the wolf, but they're seeing in the wolf the same thing that the large ground finch is seeing in the local finches. The wolf has all the DNA of all the different dogs around the world today that they have to a lesser degree. And if you look at all the purebred dogs, that's why if you breed purebreds, they don't last very long. They have too close a genetic match. They get all kinds of physical problems early. That's why if you crossbreed them and you wind up with a mongrel, you have a much healthier dog for a longer period of time. Essentially, all of these breeds came from one dog kind originally, and that is well observed. So Darwin was seeing exactly the opposite of his theory there. Well, folks, essentially, the whole thing collapses. When you look at it from a science perspective, Darwinian evolution, which is increased complexity, is not observed and it's not supported by anything we can see. In fact, all of the mechanisms like mutations and all of those things lose information, never gain it. But gaining information and adding to the code is necessary for Darwin to turn an ape into a man or to turn a reptile into a bird or turn anything into something else. That's not what's observed. That's only assumed on the part of the evolutionist. And by the way, This is so well documented that many evolutionists have left evolution, and they don't believe it anymore, but they have to stay quiet about it, because if they don't, they would wind up losing their jobs. Many of them have turned to something called ID, which is intelligent design, which is a first step, but it doesn't go far enough, of course. But look at what one famous scientist said. This is Dr. Colin Paterson. He's the senior paleontologist at British Museum of Natural History in London. Pretty prestigious position, right? Look what he said. One of the reasons I started taking this anti-evolutionary view was last year I had a sudden realization that for over 20 years I thought I was working on evolution in some way. One morning I woke up and something had happened in the night, and it struck me that I had been working on this stuff for 20 years and there was not one thing I knew about it. There's that root word for science, knowledge. So he developed a question. Can you tell me anything you know about evolution? Any one thing that's true? He says, I tried that question on the geology staff at the Field Museum of Natural History, and the only answer I got there was silence. I tried it on the members of the Evolutionary Morphology Seminar at the University of Chicago, a very prestigious body of evolutionists, and all I got there was silence for a long time, and eventually one person said, I do know one thing, it ought not to be taught in high school. Those are the evolutionists talking. So I don't need to say anything else. So I'm done. So hopefully this session, and you look like you're still alive. If you survived this big, heavy one, our longest session, now the rest of them you should be able to breeze through, because we're going to have fun with the next one, because now we're going to flip the coin. So in a few minutes when we get gathered back here, and I'll let you determine when we're going to come back, we'll flip the coin and we'll have some fun looking at a program called The Hunters and the Hunted. This is one of our staple programs, and it's why we do a wildlife safari to South Africa each July. So come back in a few minutes and we'll do that program.